Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
When can we start? When can we start? It's the first weekend review on TF3. Joining us this weekend, Dave O'Brien from Dave Talks.
Cheers, Lawrence. Thanks for the intro, mate. How are you?
Good, thank you. Good to have you on the channel. Dave, you've been at a barbecue this afternoon?
Yeah, it was a friend's birthday from university. It's always good to go and see people that you've not seen in a while. And it was a lovely sunny day, so yeah, I had a great time.
Remind people how successful you are. I've got a blue tick on Twitter. Has anyone else in this room got that? Oh, no, but you did get a first. Fair enough.
I've not got a blue tick yet, Lawrence. One day, I hope.
That is unusual. Talking of people with blue ticks, Chris Hennage, welcome back.
Good evening. I have indeed been verified as being who I said I am.
Yeah. Which I also think was part of the rehabilitation program that they said they put you on. So this all works.
Solved a chronic identity crisis, let me tell you.
Yeah, exactly. Before that, you were all over Periscope just claiming things. Anyway, let's get down to it. Unfortunately tonight, Adam Boltwood is away. And you know what? Adam Boltwood's going to be away for a little while anyway, because he's going away on a trip. So this is going to be TF3 for a little while. If you don't, I mean, he'll be back on Wednesday, but then he'll probably go away after that. And we're going to try and fit things around him, but let's see. Anyway, more on that on Wednesday. Maybe you can meet him on the way. Maybe, you know, you might be in Venezuela at the same time trafficking the same shipment of cocaine that he will also be trafficking. So that will be really fascinating. Anyway, let's get into tonight's episode. And where is better to start than last season's champions, unusual champions, Dave, being beaten 2-1 by last season's unusual champions, these guys, Hull.
Yeah, it was a real interesting game. It was a game that, in a way, it always looked like Leicester were going to lose. They were so disjoint. What we got from Leicester City last season was a solid 4-4-2, a really solid 4-4-2, where the back four was completely covered. It was the two wide players would cover the fullbacks. The two central midfielders would offer great protection to their centre-backs, which meant it a lot easier to defend for those players. Danny Simpson looked like a world beater. Christian Fuchs looked absolutely sensational. And then Huth next to Wes Morgan looked like a real tough centre-back pairing, but the issue that Leicester had is they were very disjoint. It looked more like a 4-2-3-1 with Danny Drinkwater sitting next to King and then a three behind Jamie Vardy in Mahrez, Gray and Musa. The issue there is they pressed well up higher at the pitch, but they didn't transition back to the Leicester natural position of defending deep in a 4-4-2, and that was a massive issue, and Hull City caught them out and ultimately went on to win the game. You know, there were question marks with Robert Huth not playing, but overall the structure of Leicester City looked very, very poor. It kind of like what it felt like for me, like Ranieri tried a little bit too much, too many attackers. There were four attackers consistently playing on the break, and you look at the second goal that Hull scored. It was six Leicester defenders playing against however many Hull players going forward, and then there were four attackers on the halfway line. Mm-hmm. Obviously, Hull overloaded it and scored a goal, and it's one of those things where Leicester need to evolve. But Leicester aren't going to evolve if they continue on this way. And it's a big. There's a lot of tactical questions out there for them.
Is it too simple, Dave, to say that last season it was Kante that was making up for maybe some of those holes?
Yes and no. But also I think the choice of wide player. You know, we saw last season how they balanced it beautifully in midfield. Kante in there, obviously, but you had Albrighton playing on the left-hand side, which kind of balanced Mahrez coming inside and sort of playing on the half space, playing on the counter-attack. And they just didn't have that. Musa wanted to stay up, Gray wanted to stay up, and Mahrez wanted to stay up. Didn't have any defenders in those attacking positions in midfield, which, again, went against everything Leicester did so well the season before. But I think we've got to credit Hull, you know, only having, what, 12 first-team players a few days ago before the season started, and coming on to beat the champions, you know. Snodgrass coming back from his knee injury scored a very, very good goal. But overall, I still do think they're going to go down. They don't have what it's got. They've got what it takes to stay up there. But it was a good performance and a good place to start for them, really.
Yeah, Chris, I mean, that was part of the surprise, wasn't it? Although maybe that is part of the point of David and Goliath, is that actually the whole point of the story is that it's actually the perception of strength over the idea of someone that's weak. And so, you know, I didn't really give Hull a chance at the beginning of this weekend because I thought that Ranieri would do what they were supposed to do. But the point was with Hull that they did negate a lot of what was going on with Leicester. You still think, though, the quality of Leicester should have been able to do more. And ultimately, they didn't put away the chances that they created.
They didn't. And I think Vardy in particular can be frustrated with that. He did look it. I think they were able to create some avenues. I do think a little bit, though, just to almost piggyback on what Dave said, the erosion of what was central to them last season was the idea of the unity and working together as a unit. And I think that will become a theme for us most of the season, the idea of it not being about attack and defence, it being about the team and what they contribute as a unit. And I just think Leicester had lost that. And funnily enough, Hull, which I think is something the players touched on afterwards, were able to produce that in abundance.
Interesting. Okay. So has that changed either your perceptions of either side early on in the season? Or are we still very much, Chris, sort of, this is the first real competitive game that's being played this weekend. So for a lot of sides, I think it's almost easing yourself back in. I mean, we'll finish today on Arsenal-Liverpool, where it looked like a bit of a pre-season for both sides.
Yeah, I think, you know, the funny thing is the more things change, the more things stay the same. Mm. For Leicester in particular, this is something I've seen at a fair few different teams now. When they win a championship, things change about how that team is looked at by opposition. So I talked to Liam Ridgewell about this a little bit when he won MLS Cup with Portland. And he said that the start of the next season, teams handled them totally differently. So sort of maybe three quarters of last season, teams went after Leicester and thought, we can, you know, we won't fall into the same trap as other teams. We can beat them. They're not that good. Actually, now teams are giving them credit for what they did. And as you said there, we're kind of sitting back a little bit, staying compact. That's what Hull did, basically. Leicester didn't move the ball quick enough. And too often, I think that allowed Hull to kind of just sit deep and get men behind the ball and make it now impossible for them to find space.
Yeah, that is really fascinating, isn't it? Especially when you, I think that's what's confused a lot of pundits in this season so far, is that they don't really know where to place Leicester in the table, because last season, obviously, they finished first. And a lot of people kind of want them to remain relevant. But the problem is that actually, you know, an anomaly of a season isn't really going to fit into a bigger narrative, although it does. I just think that the problem is that most people aren't writing the right stories. Man of the match overall in this one? For either side, Chris? You could say Snodgrass, essentially. He seems to be representing something at that side right now.
You were reading my mind there. I would have said Snodgrass. I think his goal was good. I like just his overall hustle. I think he gives them a little bit of dynamism in attack, but a bit more consistency than someone like Abel Hernandez does.
Yeah, and then obviously Hernandez was the other significant name out there that hasn't been poached from Leicester yet. A lot of people, and I think a lot of people do stand with from Hull. A lot of people do stand with the Hull fans at this point in saying that they do think their club has been mismanaged. And I think a lot more people should be talking about it. However, it does look like there is going to be a takeover from a Chinese body. So let's see what that is very, very soon. Leicester fans dealing with, you know, being as irrelevant as some of the other sides in the Premier League very well. I'm joking. Am I? Let's go into Burnley-Swansea, Chris. Now, most people tipping Burnley to go down this season, but, you know, we also spoke in the preview podcast about the difference for Swansea this season and some of their signings, how they've struggled to maybe sign some of the marquee players that some other people have. And obviously, Andre Ayew has gone, who was a fairly significant player for them last season, and Bafétimbi Gomis has also been loaned out. So quite an identity change in terms of faces on the pitch. But it seems as if Swansea continue what they've already been working on for seasons.
I think the telling thing here was, of the two sides, Swansea did have a bit of Premier League quality in their team, and Burnley didn't. That was because it's not as if Burnley didn't have chances. They had opportunities, and it was some really good goalkeeping from Fabianski that kept a clean sheet for Swansea. With Burnley, I find myself so confused by the fact that last time they came up, I understood why they didn't go crazy in the transfer market. They wanted to improve the infrastructure. They wanted to improve the club sort of as a whole, and that money was used to do that. This time round, I can't fathom why Goodmanson is the only real signing of note for the first team, why they're only just now agreeing a deal with Stephen Defoe of Anderlecht. It just doesn't make sense. And I imagine it's even more frustrating if you're a Burnley fan, because, again, no team wants to be a yo-yo club, and that's quickly, I think, what Burnley are developing into.
Mm. Yeah, very good point. Although some sides have actually transitioned out of being a yo-yo club quite nicely, haven't they? I mean, you could say maybe West Brom.
They have. I think the thing with Burnley is you could argue it's not a it is not a necessity. Because of the TV money, because of that aspect of things now, it's a lot different to when West Brom were doing it and trying to find ways to fund better players than what they had. I think Burnley have got the avenue to do that now. They're just choosing not to do it. And the fact that in the week building up to this game, Sean Dyche is talking about how he kind of compared himself to Antonio Conte and all these things.
Oh, yeah.
I just think it looks a bit laughable. And it's unfortunate for Burnley, because I think they've got a lot of potential. But once they sold Danny Ings, it felt as if they didn't actually progress. And now they feel... in this weird, awkward stage.
And that is an unusual one, isn't it, Chris? Because obviously from the outside, Burnley, you know, could very much submit to the way that they're being portrayed. But I mean, at the same time, they had just gone down at that point. If you have a striker that wants to go, then it does sort of make sense to let them go. And credit to them, they're back where they wanted to be. So, you know, is it really all that awful in that sense?
I see the point that you're making, and I don't think it's an inherently bad one.
Hmm.
I just think you've got to have more ambition than that.
I agree. Yeah, I agree. And sometimes maybe progress isn't always in a straight linear fashion. And I definitely think within the Premier League and all the money that's in it, some sides are finding that out this season. And maybe Leicester found that out last season as well. Although the linear fashion of progress does seem to also be a bit unusual with the likes of Palace and West Brom. West Brom, of course, getting a 1-0 win against Palace. Where do you want to go first with this one? Because Palace are fascinating and West Brom are pretty fascinating. After the game, Pulis, Chris, came out and said, we need someone else. We need some investment.
Yeah, that's a funny one, really. I'm not sure where he's targeting with that. I think actually they looked all right. I don't think there was any huge problem with West Brom in that sense.
It's unusual, isn't it? Because actually, whilst he's complaining, maybe trying to play the injured party in a sense, Rondon obviously got his goal. Pulis spoke about stagnation, but actually Saido Berahino looked for the first time in a little while like he was actually engaging with the game, which was pretty fascinating as well.
Yeah, I think the thing with West Brom is, I guess they could lead on from Burnley in that sense, that they haven't made a huge amount of investment. But I think the players that they had still had a few levels to climb to reach their potential. Rondon being the best example.
Yeah.
The talk is they're going to get Jeffrey Schlupp
from Leicester. Of course, yeah. That's big. That'll end the stagnation.
Well, I think it's 11 and a half million they're going to have to pay.
For Jeffrey Schlupp.
Yeah. A one-time
tell me another joke, Chris.
I think actually he fits the Pulis dynamic quite well. He's a fast, direct, wide man, which is what he really likes. So it's that idea of, do you overpay for someone that you know will deliver exactly what you need, or do you spend more time scouring the market trying to find that person, perhaps abroad?
I hate to sort of foreshadow, because actually I quite like what Pulis has done with West Brom, but was that not similar to what ultimately led to the downfall of Pulis at Stoke?
To a degree, I think his issue there was he wasn't that willing to spend abroad.
What makes you say that?
He bought a lot of players that, I don't know, actually.
Charlie Adam, Peter Crouch, yeah, Cameron Jerome.
I mean, yeah, the first two weren't terrible. I think the first two delivered. There was one that always sticks in my mind, a chap called Andrew Davies, who is now at Ross County, was a Middlesbrough graduate.
At Southampton as well, I think.
Yeah, he played at Southampton. They paid, I want to say, £3 million for him.
That's not too bad.
And it just looked an utterly baffling move. I think he only played twice for them or something like that, and he had a series of loan spells away before he kind of left. And it was deals like that, I think, that just did him in the end, because it got to the point where he'd spent like £98 million on players and they just hadn't really progressed. So it will be interesting to see if he's given that opportunity at West Brom, because actually the talk was they wanted to get rid of him for that reason and didn't want to give him the money.
Dave, in complete contrast to that, is the Barcelona football of Crystal Palace this season. Truly stunning.
Yeah, to flatter, I'd say, Lawrence.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I think it's this result kind of pushes on what we were saying. You know, I've got Palace at 17th being relegated this season, and I think this is kind of going that same way. I feel Palace lack a lot.
Palace get relegated in 17th.
In 18, sorry.
There you go, okay.
I just don't think they've got the quality. I don't think signing someone like Christian Benteke is going to raise that level. Just don't think they're good enough. They're losing Bolasie, who's been a stalwart at that club for a number of years. They're going to be left with Wilfried Zaha, who has zero end product, and a midfield that's pretty dodgy. A defence that now has James Tompkins for £10 million. I just don't think they're going to be they haven't gone anywhere. They haven't transitioned anywhere. I think it's going to be that classic Pardew that the time will come that it'll be time for him to be sacked come maybe January, maybe even earlier December.
It is an unusual one, isn't it? Because obviously this Palace side at some point will go on a run where they do, you know, there's 10 games where they have 6 wins, 2 draws and 2 losses in there. 2 heavy losses, Chris. I think that's at least scheduled for just before December. And then just after that, people say, is he good enough? People say, do you remember Newcastle? Then people say, shit, Sam Allardyce isn't around anymore. And then what do Palace do?
I think, honestly, I think the Palace situation is mirroring previous clubs of his quite frighteningly.
Yes.
So he had a terrible run, like the one that he did at the end of last season with Palace at Newcastle, where post-Christmas everyone just put the brakes on. And it was so much of that was attributed to Mike Ashley and everything around there. So the fact that it then happened at Palace didn't make sense because, you know, Steve Parrish is incredibly supportive, quite ambitious for the club and all that kind of stuff. I just think there's a point where people stop listening to his ideas. And I think that happens usually after a full season. I think he's very limited in what he can do. I think he's well drilled in that. But there's not a great deal of substance after that. It's a lot of half-baked ideas that are more about not losing the game than trying to win it.
I mean, do you think that's part of the problem with Palace? And I mean, but Palace fans, I think, were quite, you know, they welcomed him with open arms. And I think, you know, they were always very willing to hear what ideas he had. And the problem is with him that essentially he comes into the club and he does have very big, quite bombastic ideas about how to play his side. And sometimes that works because Zaha and Bolasie on either wing is quite nice, Dave. But tactically, there's a point where when the players stop believing in that, then the team almost begin to not play his style anymore. And it's really unusual to watch.
I think it's that kind of situation where he's tried a number of things and it's always like he's a bit of a tinker man in a way where he's tried loads of different iterations of these attackers. And quite frankly, I think it's come to the end of the road with them. You know, the use of, you know, Bolasie in certain positions. Against West Brom, he played Lee Chung-Yung at number 10, which is not fascinating, it's confusing. Yi Chung-Yung was really good about 3 years ago playing right wing, yet he played most of the game, played 66 minutes at attacking midfield. You know, blending that with Andros Townsend, who's very inconsistent, and Zaha, that's very inconsistent, playing punching in a deeper role, like, this seems like such a mess. You know, Kabai was on the bench, came on the 77th minute for Jason Puncheon. What's that? You know, there's some big questions there. They're playing 3 wingers at attacking midfield, 1 attacking midfielder at defensive midfield, and then Yedinak. was he going to completely control the whole thing? No, he's not.
I mean, that is unusual, isn't it? Yeah, I mean, that is Chris, that is unusual, isn't it? Because I almost have this vision of him sort of going round the training ground and sort of having a word in different players' ears and sort of being like, this is your week, mate. This is your week. This is the week when you... And I think sometimes it works because we see, you know, wingers explode and all those sort of things. But it never seems as if we see an incredible cohesive performance.
No, I don't think he's someone that ekes out team performances. I think he's actually very reliant on talisman. If you look at last season, I'd say Bolasie was that talisman for a good portion of last season. And then eventually they hit call patches, as every player does. And that's sort of my issue with him is that when I've read interviews, usually of players who've left him, granted they may have an axe to grind, they usually talk about the fact that they just don't do a lot of tactical work. There's not, outside of defensive positioning, defensive work in general, there's not a lot being put in there. And if you look at his teams in general, I don't think they're that able to break teams down. I think he's someone that can orchestrate a counter-attack inside quite well and produce a team that can transition quickly. Give them the ball. Again, I'm not that sold on them being able to pass through opponents, and I think that shows in games like yesterday.
Yeah, well, one place where the destination is away from Selhurst Park, unfortunately for West, for Crystal Palace, because they're a great side and with great fans, is where Bolasie is heading. Dave, Everton 1, Spurs 1. Significant moments within this game?
Well, first, I think tactically it was fascinating, especially in the first half. You know, Everton were expecting Ronald Koeman to play a 4-2-3-1 and play like-for-like against Tottenham. You know, Tottenham last season were excellent. They did very, very well. But whenever a team played a 4-2-3-1 against them, they found it a little bit more difficult. You know, we went man for man against Spurs. You worked them out. But what Koeman did especially, they played a 3-4-3 against them. Yeah. So they had three centre-backs in, Morey, Jagielka and Holgate, who was very good in the game. A midfield four of Leighton Baines on the left, Gareth Barry in midfield with Jussi Guyon, and then James McArthur on the right. And then a front three, very interchangeable positions of Morales, De La Feo through the middle and Ross Barkley. But what that meant was that it pinned Spurs' biggest weapon on the attack back, which is their fullbacks. You know, playing with the front three in this shape, like Everton did, it meant that there was no space for their fullbacks to push on. So Kyle Walker and Danny Rose were really pinned back in that first half and really struggled. Everton dominated it for most of the game. I think it was up until the first Spurs substitution. There was around 56, 57 minutes where they brought on Janssen and the shape changed a bit. They went actually to a 4-4-2, which meant that you know, the three Everton centre-backs were now taken up by the two Spurs forwards, and there was space for the Spurs wide players, so the wing-backs had to trip back and so forth, pushed Carl Walker and Danny Rose forward to get crosses into the penalty area that kind of changed the game. And then Eric Lamella comes up with a goal running from an inside position out that caused the overload. But it was just so interesting tactically that Koeman dominated from the first half by playing a 3-4-3 against Spurs' system, and they didn't really have any answers to it. They were very flat. They couldn't get anything going. I think the midfield of Wanyama and Eric Dier is completely broken. Wanyama's a destroyer. And for me, Eric Dier is also a similar player in that area. Not quite a destroyer, but more of a reader of the game, an interceptor. But play the same role in midfield. And without someone like Moussa Dembélé, who can explode, that can drive through, that can play forward passes, they really struggled to get the ball into Eriksen's feet, into Dele Alli's feet. So I think there's going to be some questions, because if other teams set up like Everton did against Spurs, Spurs are going to have a number of issues this year that they're going to have to come over. One way to come over that, obviously, is playing with those two forwards.
And that's going to be interesting, isn't it? Because obviously, there's going to be a lot of there's going to be a lot of movement at one club, and then not very much movement at another. Chris, let's talk about some movement going on at Everton. Apparently, Kone is on his way there from Sunderland, or apparently not, according to Mr. Moyes.
Yeah, he said that Kone had no idea about the statement that was released and attributed to him. I should say. It was released by a chap called Keith Downey, who was Sky's Northeast reporter. I don't think Keith is lying or being dishonest, and I say that because I actually know the guy.
Yeah.
I think it's
is
come
he honest?
By his agent. Yeah.
Yeah.
He is.
He won't fight in a lift and then sort of, you know, say it wasn't him.
No. I think this has come from his agent, who is Willie Mackay's son. I think his name's Mark Mackay. And I can see why he's pushing the issue. I guess Moyes is just I don't know, I guess he's playing games as well. It seems a weird thing to put out in the public, to be honest. It seems like he's trying to draw a division between agent and player, or maybe even try and keep the feeling around Koenig positive among supporters, because none were too happy when he released that statement, albeit via that guy's Twitter account that I mentioned.
That's a very good point, because like you said, off air, Chris, Koenig was apparently videoed with fans saying that he hadn't been offered a new contract, which would sort of fit with the same statement.
Yeah, he's confirmed that element of the story, that the crux of the issue is, at the end of last season, he was promised a new contract, or a pay rise by Sam Allardyce for his performances. Mm-hmm. That was a verbal agreement, and it hasn't been fulfilled by the club. Now, the club's, or not the club's official argument, but the argument at least of supporters has been, it was a verbal agreement first and foremost. It was made by the previous manager, etc., etc. I kind of see both sides, in the sense of, if you give him a rise, you've got to give Kirchhoff a rise. You've arguably got to give Defoe a rise as well. And yet, if I was promised a pay rise by my boss and then it was not delivered just because he left, I wouldn't be too happy.
Yeah, because you'd imagine that that boss should have probably gone to the people above him and said, this is my long-term plan. But I mean, you know, it reminds me a little bit of in Liar Liar, when he promises his secretary that he'll give her a raise and then he doesn't, and then she goes, raise this, and then gives him the middle finger. Anyway, Chris, thanks for your seriousness there. That actually helps some fans out there who are trying to work out who's going where. Let's move on to Sunderland, though. That was the last game of the day, actually. Man City played Sunderland, Dave. It was 2-1 to Man City in the end. Obviously, in exactly the way that Pep planned it, with her own goal. Tactically, this one played out quite interestingly. But there is something very quick to put in there, which is obviously the recent transfer. McNair was the first player to score an own goal on his Premier League debut for a team since Danny Gabaldon for QPR exactly 5 years ago. Poor McNair. But Dave, tactically, this game played out fascinating in so many fascinating ways, for the Premier League at least, even if there are other people on the continent who aren't so fascinated by it.
Yeah, I think it's the introduction to the Premier League of inverted fullbacks, in a way, you know, a concept that's been used on the continent for a number of years. You know, Pep Guardiola's Bayern Munich have done this for about three seasons, where David Alaba and Philipp Lahm have pretty much come into the central midfield positions and created a midfield three with the defensive midfielder that's playing there. We saw that yesterday with Pep Guardiola, that in a lot of the game, City's formation looked like a 2-3-4-1. So two centre-backs with three players in front, which were the two full-backs,
yeah,
and the defensive midfield, Fernandinho, who was brilliant in the game. I think Fernandinho is a player that's really going to excel under Pep Guardiola. But just going back to the game, so the three players in there, were ahead of them were the two central midfielders for Manchester City, Sterling and De Bruyne, flanked either side by Nolito and Sterling, who's tactical instructions were to spread the game as wide as possible. This was crucial for Raheem Sterling's performance. Sterling had a cracking game, won the penalty, but all around was very lively, completed seven take-ons, more than any other player in the Premier League this weekend. But it gave him a new lease of life, where someone's told him to stay wide and just take people on. Simple job, but he did it very well. But also, the system created it that Sterling was given these one-on-ones. That's why you play inverted fullbacks, to create one-v-ones on the outside. Because if you play these fullbacks that come inside, hold the central space, the opposition central midfielders have an issue because they can either push up and put a bit of pressure on these two fullbacks that have come inside, or deal with the central midfielders that will be drifting behind them. So there's a lot of tactical things, which means the team has to be a lot narrower, which means that you necessarily don't need a fullback and a winger on each flank to stretch the play. You could probably do it with two wide players. But also with that, it means that there's a lot of space inside. If, you know, Kevin De Bruyne and Silva want to pull underlaps, you know, going inside those wide players, which happened a number of times on Silva's time. De Bruyne was very quiet because he's been playing in his wrong position, which is stupid under Guardiola or whatever. I'll forget that. But these underlaps on Silva's side, especially with Silva playing 1-2s with Nolito and then coming inside the man and getting into the penalty area, is very, very clever. But the issue, I think another issue as well, is I feel that these City players aren't good enough yet.
Yeah, they still have that old City swagger, which I find really weird to watch, because it looks like them trying to play intelligent tactics, but in like a Man City shirt.
Well, I think the big thing is the players aren't ready for it. you know, asking Gael Clichy to dictate the play and play number of passes forward into attacking areas and being in areas where he's under pressure is a bit too much of the player. I'm not saying he's a bad player, Gael Clichy, but he's not good enough to play that role. I was quite impressed with Kolarov. So Kolarov actually started at centre-back next to John Stones, was quite good at bringing the ball out and playing those forward passes. So maybe he has a future at playing this inverted fullback role. But I imagine as soon as Otamendi's back, he's going to be back next to John Stones, centre-back, because there were a number of times that I feel that with City, if you tell your striker to play on the outside shoulder at the centre-back, you're going to get a lot of joy this season if you get maybe an attacking midfielder combining with you, drifting the same way.
Which would be fascinating to see maybe Jurgen Klopp, Liverpool play City, those sort of sides.
Yeah, I think that Manchester United will beat them in the fourth game of the season because I feel they've got that. You know, we saw Zlatan drift. If Marcus Rashford starts that game, I feel that United have got that in the bag because that'll cause that back four a lot of problems. The other thing with City as well, when Sunderland actually put a bit of pressure on, when they were getting forward, when Van Aanholt wasn't defending, he was pretty awful defending, but when he was attacking, Sunderland looked like City. They basically, it felt like City was so uncomfortable defending, like putting pressure on them when they were sort of in their own final third defending, and their own defensive third defending. They looked so uncomfortable. Who pushes out, who goes, and you saw that with the goal. John Stones just disappeared. He pushed out too far. He got too giddy, and then obviously Jermaine Defoe gets slipped through him and finishes off a wonderful move. That was the second time that sort of similar manoeuvre happened. Jermaine Defoe had another pretty decent chance in the first half. So I feel like if you pressurise City, they'll crumble this season. They really will.
Interesting. Although maybe they'll find ways not to crumble.
I think that's the coaching, isn't it? I think that's the thing Pep's going to have to deal with and establish around that, right?
And that, and I think that's what's going to be really fascinating, isn't it, Chris? Is that actually, you know, we saw some of the criticisms of Stones and Kolarov, and also some of the praising, like Dave's already done, but some of the criticisms were they didn't quite find the position that they wanted. There was a lot of space between Stones and Kolarov. And, you know, those are all things that can be addressed. But it's also going to be interesting to see what they do addressing that goalkeeper in the back line. Because, obviously, Pep has said that, you know, Hart should rise to the challenge of being dropped because he's not been good enough with his feet. Apparently they're going for... Who are they going for? They're going for Patricio? Possibly.
Apparently it's to stay, and I've heard one of my mates in Manchester, who's got a pretty decent link with the club, was saying that they have signed to stay already, and that's going to go through in about 2 weeks.
So they've not signed him already.
As in, he's injured at the moment, so he wouldn't be able to pass a medical.
He wouldn't be able to pass a medical. But they've got an agreement in place, is what you're saying.
Apparently, yeah.
That's fascinating. Apparently they're also looking at Patricio, although maybe that is just to buy the club some time. I don't know, maybe there's something in there. But Chris, obviously that means that in the next 2 weeks, we are going to see, or going to need to see, a goalkeeper who can play with his feet. And I don't think Joe Hart's going to be particularly happy to play number two to Ter Stegen.
No, he's not. He's got international ambitions he needs to think about as well as anything.
Well, it's also that he's a pretty decent goalkeeper. It's just that he doesn't fit a feet-playing system.
He is a good goalkeeper. I don't know if the Euros did much for his reputation, though, because he seems to constantly be beaten when shots from distance are put to his left.
Yes.
And I think just in general, Guardiola is really ruthless in terms of cutting players that he doesn't think fit the system. He did that at Barcelona when he first earned promotion to the first team. He got rid of players like Deco and people like that who, in his eyes, just didn't do what he needed them to do from a playing standpoint. So I'm not surprised.
From a lifestyle standpoint, I mean, but that's not really a criticism of Hart. Apparently, he's the ultimate professional off the pitch.
No, of course he is. I think it's no surprise to see him go in that sense. I also think that maybe they can improve. That's the thing. I think it's only cruel if you don't think there's going to be a significant improvement. I would argue Ter Stegen is that improvement. Not just from his ability to pass the ball, but just in general. So it makes a lot of sense. And equally, if Man City want to achieve their goals of winning the Champions League and these kind of things, you do have to become chronically ruthless. You really don't have time for passengers.
Jesus, this man, he's chronically ruthless. I don't know why I said that. Let's just quickly look at two of Pep Guardiola's previous sides. Obviously, Dave, where he's laid down the foundations, where those clubs have then gone on and built from, but in very different ways, actually. Barcelona 2, Sevilla 0 tonight. Chris led us our attention to the lovely chest down from Arda Turan, running onto that from Luis Suarez for Barcelona's first goal. And apparently Sevilla had zero shots on target, so nobody really testing them. And then, Dave, what's fascinating, and you've said this time after time, off air, obviously, Dortmund 0, Bayern 2.
Yeah, I think it's a transition for both those sides. Barcelona obviously beating Sevilla, but Sevilla in massively in transition, going from playing under Unai Emery to playing under Sampaoli is a pretty big thing. You know, the thing that, interesting, the possession stat that massively swung away from, usually you'd expect Barca 60% versus Sevilla, what's that, dropping to 51%, yep. Which is interesting in itself, that Sevilla want to hold the ball a lot better under Sampaoli. But I think that will come. I think the big question for Barca, who's going to be that fourth forward? Munier put in a pretty decent showcase tonight for his talents. They've been linked with Paco from Valencia. It would be interesting to see if he makes the transition over to Barcelona. But then again, going back to Borussia Dortmund, there were some good performances in central midfield. Roda playing pretty well. Dembele showing off. Ramos putting a bit in there. But they're just not being that good enough, dominating the ball, but not having that final thrust. And Bayern Munich obviously coming through and winning the game. You know, what else can you do? They've got so much depth of quality in there. What you're taking off Frank Ribery for Kingsley Coman. There's just so much variation in that attack and midfield. Matt Hummels not having the best of games as well, you'd say. He does have that, though, every like 10 games or 12 games. Matt Hummels just seems to have a bit of a stinker. But then the rest of them will be pretty awesome. So I think it's just a bit of adjustment for him. But yeah, no, well done to Ancelotti for winning his first German title.
Yes, although he Hummels does look good in a Bayern shirt. It's unusual, isn't it? Because you're so used to seeing him in that yellow.
It's different. His boots look very good tonight. Very, very nice boots.
What kind of boots were these, Dave?
Adidas. Lovely Adidas. I think they were red ones. Really orangey.
Oh, not red ones. Oh, red ones. Good, do you think? Do you think they were ace?
They were pretty ace, mate.
Yeah. Tell you what, Dave. They're probably not the first pair of boots he's worn, although first never follows. Let's move on to actually how your fantasy guys did this weekend. Dave, you're big into your fantasy football. And you know what? The other day I joined and actually cared about for the first time the Front Three Fantasy League. I didn't realise there were so many people in it.
Yeah, come on, Lawrence.
Dave.
There's loads.
Dave,
it's big.
There's like six or seven pages of names.
Yeah, it's good.
I didn't realise it was
right?
That big. The lads really are in.
The lads are absolutely in.
Did you have a good first fantasy weekend?
I had a very poor first fantasy weekend,
too.
Lawrence.
I think I was just above average of the rest of the country.
Yeah, you know, I had Ibrahimovic, I had Aguero, which did very well. But I was disappointed with my defence, my goalkeeper. I had Joe Hart in there.
Yeah.
I didn't see. So I did actually. So on Saturday morning, come 11 o'clock, so that's in the UK when the deadline's at 11:30 in the UK. I was trying to put in check for Hart. Obviously, that would have been even worse.
Yeah.
The lost points with check. But I was trying to, bash that confirm button, but the servers were down. See you later, Dave. You should have done a transfer early.
Should have thought of this on Friday night when you were in the office trying to waste time.
Exactly. But the thing with midfield, I've got Delafeo, who missed a 1v1. Clean through on goal. Should have definitely scored. Tadic, who had a very good game, created five chances. The most of any player in the Premier League this weekend, but didn't get an assist. Eriksen didn't have the best of games. Ramsey, so midfield let me down a bit. But up front, I've still got Andy Carroll to play, and I'm hoping that he scores a double hat trick.
Oh, that's fascinating. Do you, so you're saying six goals from Andy Carroll in
yes.
one game?
Correct.
Let's actually transition into a quick preview of that game then. Chelsea obviously play West Ham. Chris, before we talk about your fantasy team, what do you think? What are your thoughts on that game? Obviously, Conte's debut in the Premier League, along with a Bilic who wants to impress.
I actually think West Ham could win this, and I think there will never be a better time to play Chelsea than right now. And I say that because, as much
you
as
seen them last season.
Well, the thing is, as much as we're theorising about how they will line up and how they will look, I imagine Chelsea are almost doing that themselves, because this is the first kind of competitive kick under Conte, so that there'll be kinks to be worked out. I'm really not bothered how well or how good they've looked in pre-season. There'll be problems discovered tomorrow that will, I think, come through okay in time. But again, I think West Ham are a lot more suited and a lot more harmonious than Chelsea will be, just because they haven't had the chronic changes.
Yeah, it is fascinating. Although, obviously, there is some sort of public signal there that Conte is relatively happy with the squad that he's fallen upon. Although maybe he's been told he's going to get some time, so maybe he's trying to make this team work. We'll see. Or maybe people didn't want to go to Chelsea because they don't believe in the project. A lot of different narratives there to be written. Chris, I'll come back to you in a second for your fantasy stuff. Dave, your preview for the Chelsea-West Ham game, do you actually legitimately think that they're going to score some goals on Chelsea, or is this conjecture?
I think it's going to be a really interesting game because Conte has been flapping about with his formations in pre-season, 4-3-3, 4-5-1.
Flapping about or experimenting?
Yeah, a bit of both, I think. I think he still doesn't know what his best side is. He still doesn't know how to play this Chelsea side. Because I think there's just players there that aren't Conte players. Fabregas is a big one, mm-hmm. Just not Conte at all. But I feel like Fabregas has been banging in pre-season. I feel like Eden Hazard has been great in pre-season. I feel he'll continue that form. So he's a man to watch. It's going to be this West Ham defence. Aaron Cresswell was a massive, massive blow. He was brilliant from left back last season. So who are they going to bring in for that is going to be quite interesting. Figuli, who fantasy football-wise, 5.5 could be a really good option in there. But again, poor season at Valencia, good pre-season. Let's see how he does. Payet's not injured, he's come back from the Euros late, so he won't be playing apparently. But I do think Andy Carroll could really cause this Chelsea backline some problems, you know, with his movement, with his aggression. If he fancies it, and I think this might be a day where he does. Mikel Antonio as well, who had a brilliant end to the last campaign, is always going to be a danger down that right-hand side. So, yeah, I think...
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
It's going to be, I think I'm going to go with a 2-2 draw.
Interesting. Desmond, Chris, I won't come back to you for prediction. I know you don't like making them. Your fantasy football, is that, do you do fantasy football?
Not really.
Good. Good boy.
I don't...
You don't fool yourself at the beginning of the season into thinking that it's worth putting aside that you'll then leave a week later because you don't really do it anyway.
Pretty much, yeah. I don't have the commitment to go back and change it every week and sit and agonise. It's just not something that interests me.
You don't have to agonise over it.
I would, though. I know I would. I haven't played it in the past. I know I would.
Yeah. Yeah, fair enough. Then, Chris, I'm going to stick with you for a minute because we were talking off-air as a three about how much we missed Adam and how good he was at sort of bringing things together. And we were sort of saying how there's a bit of frustration over maybe some other places where it seems now there's a lot less about actually painting a true story and a lot more about painting the story the way that you would like to see it. And what we were kind of saying was it's a really good way to equip yourself at the beginning of the season to work out where you're going to get your stories. And I was saying to both of you, where would you go this season to get a story that you believe is a sort of a true representation of what is going on at a club? Chris, you said you go to Twitter, but then that comes down to yourself to sort of curate things. Do you think you've curated a good follower list on Twitter, people that you follow?
I think so. I think I went on a small mass unfollowing just before the season started.
Yeah. Thanks for that. I don't know why. I didn't wonder when my number dropped.
You rarely tweet, if anything.
I think... Follow.
Let the record reflect, I do still follow that.
Yeah, it's good, yeah.
So that is definitely part of it. I think, for me personally as well, I do like to go to Reddit. I find that quite a decent place, if not always for news. I think it is very good for that. It's usually even better for debate.
Interesting. In what way? Like, do you actually? It's not sort of like a. You're a massive dick, and I'm always right. People turn their heads when I debate. Sort of area.
Yeah, I think what's good about it is the moderators or the people that control it are quite vigilant about kind of removing that. And the good thing is as well, because it's got obviously the upvote downvote system, you've got a thread that has, I don't know, 100,000 comments. You can set it to top, and usually the top upvoted comment is not something stupid. It's something that actually has a little bit of detail and kind of intelligence to it. So it's good in that sense. And like I say, I can honestly say I've learned a variety of different things just from scanning there and reading through different discussions.
For instance, that Cunnilingus was not a left back for Spurs in the mid-90s. Dave, do you agree?
I think Reddit's the best place to get creative content because it is that system of voting. It is up and down. You know, if some clickbait comes onto it or whatever, you're down. And when you're up, you're up. So it's fine. You know, there's fascinating things. You can go on to football tactics, whatever you want to see. I think that's the great thing. Our fantasy football, which is a great one for your fantasy football tips. Then there's loads of different things you can find on Reddit. You know, there's a lot of niches, and I think that's the beauty of it.
Interesting. Good. Both of you on Reddit quite regularly?
Yeah, it's pretty much 24/7, Lawrence.
365. 369. But you can't sort of follow one specific person on Reddit, or can you? I don't know.
No, not to my knowledge.
So it's not like someone can sort of go along and go, oh, Dave is looking at this.
I think you can't tell what I was doing if you wanted to.
You can bookmark the person, and then their profile will show everything that they've submitted or written or anything like that.
Great. I knew that Kristen would know that. And have you done that often, either of you?
No.
What's her name?
What's her name, Chris?
I'm joking. Kristen isn't allowed to speak about his personal life on the podcast. We've been through this once, Dave. Drop it.
Sorry, Chris.
Middlesbrough Stoke 1-1. Chris, this is fascinating because this is one of the only teams in your area that's still represented in the Premier League. And of course, they're on Tyneside, aren't they?
Teesside.
I knew that that would get your back up when I said that. That's the only reason I said it. No, but obviously...
I was surprised, to be honest. Fair play, you got me hook, line and sinker there, because yeah. I thought, he's not this stupid. He knows that Teesside is a place.
He does know that Teesside is a place, and it's not just the shortening of a name. And we know how desperate Middlesbrough are to be in that sort of relationship, and they're always teased about not being part of that. But there's something sort of almost... there is a bit of the furniture was missing for quite a long time in the Premier League, wasn't it, Chris? And I know that maybe you won't acknowledge that up in the Tyneside area, but it was very much like they just sort of got straight back into it. And there's something quite nice about that, because there are shades of sort of the Ravanelli, Janino era about this side.
Yeah, I don't think the way they played or the signings they made were bombastic at all that of a newly promoted team.
Yep.
And I think actually the comparison with Janino Ravanelli is quite an astute one.
I know.
That because of the likes of Negredo and people like that, they've seemed to find a very good harmony between getting players that are established names and then also players that still have a good bit of life left in their career. So Negredo was arguably the best example. Valdez, free kick aside, is another good one. And I think actually it sets them up for quite a good foundation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then what about the Stoke side of things? Exactly.
It's a weird one, Steph. I just have a feeling they're going to maybe regress a little bit this season. I have such a conflicting opinion on Mark Hughes as a manager, because I can't tell. I think, honestly, some of my opinion of him is rooted in the fact that I just don't like him very much.
There's something about it. It's still that whole handshake thing, isn't it?
A little bit, yeah. It's that thing of there's no kind of glaring issue with the way he manages, per se. But I just think, I don't rate you. I don't know what it is. I mean, look, if there's a Stoke fan out there with an opinion that agrees or conflicts, I'm happy to hear it. I just find that he's a little bit self-aggrandizing. He likes to blow smoke up his own butt.
Yeah. I mean, we've all met someone like that at some point in our lives. Not least on TF3. It is interesting, although if you believe that you out there relate to Mark Hughes, tweet us with the hashtag #IAmMarkHughes and let us know that you're in solidarity with the manager who doesn't seem to have very many fans within the Premier League. We'll see very soon. And obviously, there was Chris, the interesting thing about that game was that it almost seemed that as Middlesbrough sort of tired and allowed Stoke back into the game, that was what let Stoke back in.
Yeah, I think essentially, as can often be the case, the first day, all the excitement and all that kind of thing, Middlesbrough just went a little bit too hard on the gas pedal.
Yeah.
And it left them just kind of a little bit tired, a little bit worn out by the end of things. But there's enough within that 90 minutes, I think, for them to take positives and believe that they can actually stay in this league.
I do also think that's what is quite positive about a Championship game compared to a Premier League game, is that actually, fitness-wise, it is a different kind of fitness in the Premier League, but there's a very good basis sort of set down in the Championship for sort of coming up to the Premier League, if you like, for a lot of these guys. It's not that there's a massive disparity between the two leagues in terms of that, is it?
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
Yeah, at least you'd see that. And obviously Ramirez also of note there, Chris.
Yeah, I think that's one of the big takeaways, is that he seems to have finally really grasped how to play in England. Because it's Southampton, he looked very soft, he looked very timid. I don't think he was too keen on the pace of things. Mm-hmm. But now, having been at Southampton for a few years, and then also at Middlesbrough, he seems to know when he can play and when he should maybe just lay it off or get rid of it.
Interesting stuff. Speaking of transitioning away from things, Southampton and Watford, you called this one. What did you call this one, Chris? I quite like the way that you labelled it.
I think it was the new team derby or something.
The all-change derby,
that was it.
Nice. In the last 3 years, they've had 6 different managers between the two of them.
Yeah, and it's... Yet they haven't seen a significant drop-off. If you were to paint that story, you would usually think it finishes with, and they were relegated. Actually, both teams seem well set up for change and constant change at that, so it's going to be curious to see how they do this season, because you could argue this might be the first time that they actually feel the consequence of that change.
Yeah, that is actually quite interesting for both these sides this season. The preview podcast, we said very interesting things about them. Maybe go back and listen to that one. We'll see. I think for both those sides, a 1-1 draw probably came out about fair in the end. Dave, we're going to come to you now for the way that Sunday began, which was the excitement around Manchester United, the excitement around seeing the new iteration of this Bournemouth side. And so Mourinho plays his first Premier League game as Manchester United manager. Real Premier League game, because, of course, Facebook and Wayne Rooney's testimonial claimed that that was the Premier League. And obviously Mourinho fielded a Manchester United side without the likes of Pogba in it, without the likes of Mkhitaryan in it. And his goal scorers, Dave, were 3 people that a lot of people felt, whilst they're very capable, wouldn't be in the picture during this Mourinho era, which was Mata and Rooney. And then obviously Ibra on top of that, who's very much in the picture. But what's interesting about that, Dave, is 3 older guys. So Mata, older, Rooney, 30s, Ibra, 34.
I think that's just the experience, right? That's just football is going in a way where players can play for longer, have a longer career and still have that top level. I think the interesting part about that game is that we're slowly seeing what a Mourinho team is like at Manchester United, you know, playing in a 4-2-3-1. That's been the case in the 2 competitive games that drop into a 4-4-1-1 without the ball. The more direct, he's galvanising players. Marouane Fellaini, again, had a very, very decent game, won 6 out of his 10 tackles, won twice as many tackles as any other player on the pitch, misplaced a single pass out of 57 passes, which is very, very impressive. Kept things ticking over, disrupted well, played a brilliant role at goal kicks. When Bournemouth had goal kicks, Mourinho made sure they couldn't play out the back. He pushed his 2 strikers up against their centre-backs. He pushed up Ander Herrera up against their defensive midfielder and let Marouane Fellaini pretty much have a 1v1 in the central zone that he obviously won because of his strength in the air. Very tactically, very interesting. But I think the interesting part of this game was both up front for Manchester United and at the back for Manchester United. First, let's start at the back. You know, you've got players like Eric Bailly, who've come to the Premier League pretty unknown, but what we've seen so far, he's very aggressive, positionally very sound, and very, very good on the ball. Completed 93% of his passes against Bournemouth, but defensively as well. Made two interceptions, three tackles, and seven clearances. Then you look at Daley Blind, you think, Daley, he's going to be pushed out of the team. Absolutely not. For me, Daley Blind was one of Man United's best players last season. I put him up there with David De Gea. And again, he showed his quality, real, real quality. You know, two massive moments in the game where he pretty much stopped a goal. Firstly, just at the start of second half, Shaw got done on the inside by Jordan Ibe. Who's coming over to make the block? It's Daley Blind. The ball breaks at Bournemouth counter-attacking. Daley Blind has a 1v1 versus Callum Wilson. Daley Blind stands him up, makes the tackle, wins the ball back. Very, very, very good display from Daley Blind. And it's going to be hard for Chris Smalling to get back into the side. I think Mourinho's probably come to Manchester United and thought, Daley Blind, nah, he's not really centre-back. But these games that he's seen, he's probably very, very impressed.
It is interesting. And obviously, Chris, there's so many more Manchester United discussion points out there as well. Obviously, Ibra, in his pre-match comments saying, when asked about previous sides that he played for, he said, I came, I won, and I went. Obviously, so heartfelt the way that he has a relationship with previous sides. It is interesting to see the way that Manchester United are sort of playing this season. That experience there, obviously Mourinho knows how to get the best out of experienced strikers. It's going to be really fascinating, isn't it, to see how he brings through this youth, you know, the Pogbas, the other youngsters within this side.
Yeah, because he's obviously just sold some of them off in McNair and Love, and I'm not saying that either were likely to contribute. I think McNair was maybe a little bit more likely, but even then, that's pushing it, I think, to say he would have a long-term future at the club.
When he sold them both off, do you think he sold them off and it was known as the day that McLovin left Manchester United?
I think it will be interesting to see how he does that, though, because he was very eager, I think, in pre-season to talk about the famous 49 players that he's handed debuts to as youngsters, when actually if you look through that, a lot of those were quite literally 1 minute appearances.
But they are still debuts.
I mean, they are, but then
they're not, are they? It's not the same as bedding a player into a side, is it?
No, exactly. It's not to draw the most obvious comparison, the class of 92 having long, illustrious careers at Manchester United, or maybe even someone like Darren Gibson, who served a purpose for a brief period and then was moved on. That is essentially the problem, is that he needs to start bedding in youngsters that actually contribute to the team long term and don't just count to a statistic.
Well, is it also maybe worth saying within that, Chris, that Mourinho knows that winners essentially get to write a lot of the headlines, and so he knows what he's doing in that sense?
I think so. I also think he knows that there will be those of us sad enough to actually go and check those numbers out and see how it looked and how those players' careers developed. I just think in general the only way he's going to have legitimate success with Manchester United is by doing that.
Chris, but before we go back to the match, what I did find quite interesting was that Mourinho said, journalists need to learn to read me better. And that was in reference to the Juan Mata debacle that went on in the press, as the sub was subbed, as a lot of people say. He says, if I didn't want Mata, he would not be here. The press need to learn, or people, more to the point, need to learn to read me better. A really funny, almost ironic quote.
Yeah, it's almost like he's back to his best in that sense.
Because essentially you've seen him at his best in the press room at Sunderland and Newcastle, haven't you?
The famous sort of exchange I had with him, rather, where I asked him about whether Chelsea had lost the ability to win 1-0, and he said it was the easiest result in football and they could do it any time they wanted. Funnily enough, he didn't seem to do it that much after we had that conversation.
Do you feel like you essentially psyched him out there?
No, I don't think it was so much that. I think it was a case of
he almost knew himself. Did you know, like, cock-piss Mourinho down the side of his car?
I didn't. Good. But I do think he almost, in saying that, acknowledged it unintentionally, that they maybe had lost the ability to close out games as they once did. And I think that's something that Manchester United will need to develop. They'll need to be able to win games 1-0, because actually if you look at almost any title-winning side from the start of the Premier League, they've been able to do that. And I think whenever he's failed, it's usually because they've lost that.
And I think that is, Dave, where things are going to get very interesting for Manchester United, is the structure of this side is explored by Mourinho. Obviously, we saw the structure on the weekend of this side with a spine of Zlats and Ruiz. Dave?
Sorry.
Dave, are you turning your camera on?
I misclicked the mic.
Okay. Ah, right. Okay, got you. Then, okay, that's what I found fascinating. I was like,
shit, I need to click the mic and I missed it.
People who are just listening, the fascinating bit is that Dave just tried to turn his camera on. I think we were all worried that we were going to see something. Anyway, Dave, go on. The spine was Latin, really.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting one. You know, as mentioned in the preview, the issue with both players making the same movement. I think we saw that in the first half. United got a lot better when there was a bit of variation in that. We had Rooney ahead of Zlatan at some times. I think that's where Manchester United need to go. The issue with Rooney playing in attacking midfield is he just kills everything centrally. When Rooney gets the ball, he stops the attack, he comes back on himself, he plays a square pass, he plays a backwards pass, which just kills the momentum, and it means that the opposition have that time to regain the position and build that bank of four. And against someone like Bournemouth, who covered the most distance in the Premier League last season, are very, very good in transitioning from defence to attack or attack to defence, just because they put the work in. And a game like this, it was frustrating, especially within the first half. You know, look at the goal. It was a defensive error that was capitalised on that was scored in the first half. Wan-Mata just getting in behind and pretty much the centre-back bottling it and, you know, playing a pass back to his keeper not long enough, and then Mata getting in and scoring. The issue that was sort of resolved in the second half, we saw Rooney running in behind and making those runs. You know, you look at the back heel that Zlatan played through to Rooney to play and play for a goal. Rooney should have scored that. The goal that Rooney scored, played a very traditional number nine role there. You know, he was involved, in quotation marks, earlier on in the move. But it was nothing to do with the goal. He played a simple pass in central midfield that went out, and then he moved forward and got into the penalty area. A great break from the right-hand side. I think that this Mourinho team, is going to be good at counter-attacking down the flanks and then getting it into the box. It's going to be a little bit different than transitioning centrally, which has happened before with like Mesut Özil or Wesley Schneider. It's going to be more wide, going to Mkhitaryan, going to Martial, or going to Jesse Lingard, and then coming into the penalty area. Because I feel if United do hit the two strikers a bit too early, kills the momentum of attack, especially with Wayne Rooney. So I feel that playing Zlatan off Wayne Rooney could be a very good option, or even Zlatan off Marcus Rashford would be interesting,
Dave, that they couldn't play Lingard today, right? Or they didn't start with Lingard today.
So he's injured, apparently.
Yeah.
I think it might be a calf injury.
Yeah. I mean, it's just interesting considering how prominent he was in pre-season. Going to be fascinating to see when he comes back. And obviously Martial playing quite significant roles in two of the goals. So it is going to be interesting to see how the structure of that side improves with the implementation of players like Pogba, etc. Two tweets coming in. One coming in from Joe Hamlin, who says Adam should have basically Adam needs to worry about losing that bet this season with you, Dave. And then obviously Stebin Alex says, how good was that Ibra goal? Dicks out for Ibra, lads.
Interestingly, that Ibra goal has pushed Ibrahimovic to the top scorer from outside the area in the last two seasons. If you want to check out more about Ibra's long-range shooting, jump over to Dave Talks. I did a great little section about his different variation of how he scored goals from outside the area.
Interesting. And I think it's also that now he's scored on his debut for
his last four clubs, I think.
I think it's his last four clubs, which means he scored for where did he come from?
Barca? PSG.
PSG. Where was he there? Inter. Where was he before that? Barca, yeah. Barca, PSG.
Barca, PSG, Inter.
All of which went on to win the Did he win the Champions League at Barcelona? He won the league. No. He won the league at each of those clubs, didn't he?
Yeah.
Yes. Fascinating. now two sides who are looking to challenge big time for the league this season finished off the weekend, at least the known weekend, not Chelsea, West Ham, as Liverpool took a trip to the Emirates and then took a trip in the first half, Chris, in what was quite an open, almost pre-season-esque looking game at times.
It was. I think that's one of the things we have to remember about the start of the season is that actually teams are still formulating ideas and all the planning and games that they've played in pre-season are great. There are still elements that are decided by actual testing and competitive matches. And I think that was typified in this game.
But that was what was quite unusual, Chris, is that obviously with Liverpool, there are some fascinating formation issues there, which definitely came up in this game. Henderson and his ability to sort of control midfield. Is he able to control midfield alongside someone like Adam Lallana, who's now playing much deeper for Liverpool, along with sort of Mane and a lot of Liverpool players starting deep for this one and counter-attacking. And obviously Arsenal's inability to deal with that. And part of that inability to deal with that, Chris, was that Wenger said, and I found this fascinating, physically, we aren't ready.
Yeah, if it means fitness, then...
Well, you've had the same amount of time as everyone else. And essentially, exactly. You should be building that in, right?
Exactly. What I would agree with him, and again, this is me sort of interpreting, is I don't think they had enough intensity or aggressiveness in their play.
Sure.
I thought they were actually really meek for large parts of this. And Liverpool's willingness to kind of get physical with Arsenal, I think, really unsettled them. And I think that's why you're seeing so many fans frustrated at this point, is because it seems like the more the changes around them, the more stays the same at Arsenal. And by that I mean that each passing summer, not a great deal changes. In fact, Guy put up a graphic denoting how much each team had spent this summer, and then also I think it was during the last nine summers.
Was just with Arsenal, was that spend or
net spend?
It
was, I believe it was just outlay. It was not net spend.
Got you. Well, you got to talk about net spend if you want to talk about Arsenal, Chris.
And it was quite a drop off. I think it was, I want to say it was four times less than what Man United had spent this summer, and then about half of what they had spent over the, I'm pretty sure it was the last 9 years.
Wow.
And the thing is, you can be principled about it all you want with Arsene Wenger, but there comes a point where you actually just have to spend money. And
where it becomes almost dogmatic.
Well, this is the thing. Today, I think, actually, for all we talk about the teams and the styles and all this kind of thing, I actually think Liverpool really benefited from an individual being able to turn the game for them.
Coutinho
in some instances, because he wasn't brilliant throughout. It was very much kind of little momentary patches of just brilliance. And then also Mane with his individual goal. I don't know if Arsenal have enough of those players. I think someone like Granit Xhaka can build into a bigger system and can help unlock spaces for that kind of player, like a Mane or a Coutinho. I don't think he does it by himself, though. I don't think he is someone that will pick the ball up and then, you know, score or something like that. So that, for me, is the frustration as I watch Arsenal, is that even now they could have had so many good players through the door, but for whatever reason, he just doesn't want to do the deal at any point.
Yeah, that is really fascinating. And obviously...
Big question there, though, quickly, just to jump in. Like, imagine if Arsenal had signed Sadio Mane, you know, wouldn't that be perfect for them, right? You know, a player that just describes exactly what Kristen just said that Arsenal need. They have players like Xhaka that can build an attack, Santi Cazorla, Aaron Ramsey. The list goes on and on, but they need that pace changer in the final third in a way.
But I mean, surely
Mane could have been perfect, right?
But surely that is then people like Oxlade-Chamberlain. I mean, they sort of have other players that fit together and make what Mane does for Liverpool
again,
on an individual basis
part of
the system. He was great. I mean, his explosiveness for his own goal was brilliant.
I think that's a crazy thing as well. Why didn't he start? Had a great pre-season. Again, had
fitness.
A brilliant pre-season.
Fitness.
Yeah, fitness. But what... It's kind of like going back to that old thing of, yeah, we used to play 40 games a season. We drank pints, we smoked and whatever.
Yeah, but look
surely,
at them now.
I understand that there's a level of fitness you've got to get to, and there's all this periodization and all this rubbish, but you've got to be fit, right? I don't give a crap how long your pre-season is. You're a professional footballer. In that time of pre-season, however long it is, you need to be able to be physically prepared for the first game of the season. As well with like blaming Wenger and blaming owners about how he's not spent the money, there's got to be some level of, there's an issue here with the training staff, or there's something here that if they're not, they're physically prepared, someone's got to cast the blame for that, right? Someone's got to take that on the chest.
Or maybe someone has to take responsibility of getting them up to that level. Because it's certain, it's quite interesting that they're actually playing a Liverpool side that most of them look fitter than they've looked in a very long time at Liverpool. And so obviously there's that contrast. Wenger, although Wenger very much operates somewhat within a bubble, which I think frustrates slash allows Arsenal certain excuses. And it is, I mean, you know, Chris was talking about the dogma of the approach to transfers. It's very similar with the way that he approaches injuries. I think I heard it on TalkSport that he was questioned as to why Koscielny didn't start the game. And his answer was a very interesting one, because he basically said the reason he didn't start the game was because he was at the Euro. Someone said, well, then why did you start Ramsey? And he said, he pretty much replied with Ramsey left the game because he was injured, which is fascinating because it meant that he went against his own rule to then break his own rule to then prove his own rule right, possibly? I don't know.
So, again, a question. So, Martial obviously didn't play as much for the Euros. I was just trying to think of an example off the cuff.
I mean, it means loads of them. I mean, there's lots of them.
I just can't. I physically don't understand. If you guys have got any explanation to, a player finishes an international tournament, you give them X amount of rest.
He says 4 weeks.
Give them a certain amount of rest to get them fit for the season. Don't have an excuse for someone like Koscielny or Giroud, two players that are pretty pivotal to this Arsenal team, not being there on the first day of the season. For me, that is completely wrong.
Yeah, I mean, it is pretty fascinating. I don't know if there is a sort of a reply that's a public reply. It's also fairly fascinating in the sense that he was questioned in The Guardian just the other day. A lot of people literally, I think it was on the morning of the match, saying, what do you think about transfers? And Chris, it was a very interesting answer he gave where he said, new players are just new players. They do not remain new players forever.
Again, that just sounds, for want of a more eloquent phrase, that just sounds like bollocks to me. It really does.
You do sort of see why that, what he means by that as well, though, don't you? And I mean, I understand.
It's just an excuse.
But essentially, Arsenal do need new players, or they need new players in certain positions because of the way that they operate. And he's refusing to buy those players. Some people saying that's a striker in Lacazette, who I believe this weekend scored a hat trick. Even if it is in Liga, that doesn't really matter. And then obviously also in Mustafi as well. So it's kind of interesting because in many ways, I think Wenger's answers are right. But at the same time, if you're looking for a solution or whatever, then he doesn't seem to have a solution. And that seems to be the problem here.
They need variety in that squad. That's the problem. They've got too many of the same kind of player. And they also, I don't think, have enough depth either. And the fact that, again, he keeps finding reasons not to spend money, I don't understand it. And he can use as many different kind of ways to dress it up and say what you want about, you know, new players aren't new players forever. They've needed investment for a while relative to their ambitions, and he just hasn't done it.
Interesting. I also find it unusual. I mean, a couple of Arsenal fans I saw pre-game on Twitter saying, why can't we get new, exciting players? I know you shouldn't really put all fans in as one, but I instantly thought the answer was, well, Sanchez and Ozil are very exciting. You know, Cazorla is exciting. Oxlade-Chamberlain is exciting. You know, I mean, even Iwobi is exciting. So there's a lot of excitement in that side. I do find it unusual. I also find the analysis of Arsenal and the entitled nature with which some people, I'm not saying you guys, but some people do analyse Arsenal is also fascinating. And just because Arsenal don't fit the analysis, so many people seem to get quite angry with Arsene Wenger. It really is fascinating. On the other side, Liverpool won 4-3. And Dave, already we've mentioned a couple of man of the match-esque performances. Coutinho floating in and out, but ultimately with two great moments. And then a couple of other people in there with sort of floaty in and out moments. But the key man for me, or at least the most active man on the pitch, it looked like, was Mane.
Yeah, I think Mane had a great performance again. What Liverpool need to get out of Mane is that every single week, something that was difficult to come by at Southampton. There was phases where there were spells of games where he performed like that every single week. And I think against Arsenal, yeah, I'd agree, he's one of the best players on the pitch. Dribbled past more opponents, won more tackles than any player, drew the most fouls, and obviously scored a very brilliant individual goal. Mm. But I quite like the Coutinho performance. You know, we said on the preview of the season that Coutinho needs to stop scoring the brilliant goals and start scoring the easy goals in some respects. That's what I was sort of coming at. Against Arsenal, he scored a brilliant goal, but he also scored a very simple goal, and that's happened. And that's what you want Coutinho to do as a Liverpool fan. You want him to get him into those right areas. He's very composed. The finish for the Kleinkel cross was fantastic.
Yes.
But you need that brilliance and that simplistic nature of that goal. So I think with Liverpool, it's looking quite good. But again, a little bit open, you know, letting Arsenal back into the game with a three-goal lead. Yeah, a little bit frustrating. I imagine you were sweating buckets.
To be honest, I don't think I was sweating. It was hot in London, but I don't think I was sweating so much because, I'm almost just enjoying the ride at this point. It's not so much about winning as a Liverpool fan anymore. It's more just about sort of getting that entertainment. But that is also, I guess, what's ultimately very frustrating is that there's nothing entertaining about watching Alberto Moreno dive in on Theo Walcott in the box, or say Simon Mignolet hesitate when coming out. If you want to get that pleasure from watching players play, then you want to sort of see them playing to their very best of their ability. And for that reason, you know, Karius is probably going to end up as Liverpool's number one, and Moreno is probably not going to be Liverpool's first choice left back. Although it is interesting that Liverpool have not been linked with many left backs over the summer, even in the press. And now it seems to be most people's number one priority. Moreno is a fascinating player. Attacking wise, I think he's very much a left winger. Defensive wise, I think he's very much, left winger.
He did an Anthony Martial. I think the one criticism, though, sorry, going back to the United game, was Anthony Martial switching off for the Bournemouth goal.
Yes.
He was absolutely blinded from where Adam Smith had just sneaked in behind him. But similar to what Moreno does, and it does feel like Moreno is a left winger playing left back, because it just gets so drawn into focusing on the ball and forgetting his position and forgetting where he is, and then having to like react and making very rash tackles. And again, it happened today, gave away that crucial penalty. But then again, for the goal, you'd say potentially got done again.
Dave, he absolutely was caught up the pitch for the goal and left that side.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's. I didn't want to be too critical of him, Lawrence. I thought you might cry because it's been a bit of a slam for him. But
no, I'm fine.
Yeah, it's just one of those things where he doesn't. I don't understand. Again, this is like a similar to the Arsenal criticism with getting players back to fitness. Liverpool know they have a weakness at left back. They knew last season. Why has that not been addressed?
I honestly don't know if I have an answer for that. I wonder if it's because Liverpool have been trying to address it, but haven't found someone who fits that. And maybe if they haven't found value in the market, then they believe they can coach into the value of the team.
One single name, Patrick Rodriguez. End of.
Or even James Milner. Or just someone. I mean, just someone who can play at left back and be solid. But it also shows how if one player is weak within the system, or if one player is seen as a weakness within the system, then it's definitely an issue. And Liverpool's fullbacks on Sunday were not great, let's put it that way. Because, I mean, Klein didn't have a great game either. I think he had a 6 out of 10, even though I don't find ratings very handy. It says what kind of a game Klein had. Although attacking-wise, it was also really impressive to watch him at times. And he's a great asset, especially for the likes of Jordan Henderson in midfield as an outlet against that Arsenal side. Arsenal were obviously booed off the pitch at the end of the game. And what I do find fascinating is that people seem to assume that just because you get up and leave your chair at some point in the game, you're leaving the stadium. I will remind people, and I always find that fascinating in commentaries, they go, people are leaving already. I sort of think that some people kind of go, you know what, I need to go and get a drink, or I need to go and go to the toilet, and they're not going and getting in their car and sort of driving away from the stadium. They're just sort of leaving the arena pitch bit. And they come back in the end. But it's funny how the media construct that. Has anyone else heard about Petacek driving into the pole?
The post.
Well, apparently it was a pillar. Apparently he drove his car into a pillar.
I don't think it needs character references.
No.
I don't think he drove his car into a pillar post-match. Apparently they are quite narrow at Arsenal, and it apparently was a write-off to the car. There you go. Is that what we're going to finish on? I believe so. What have we learned this weekend? Let's finish on what we learned this weekend. Anyone learned anything on the podcast that they didn't know, maybe pre the opening whistle of the weekend? I've learned that referees can be very sort of, they've got a bit of personality now. A lot of fourth officials joking around with players at the beginning of the season. It's all very casual.
There's a pillar in Arsenal's car park you've got to watch out for.
Yeah.
I think that Ranieri's got to find the right blend between attacking talent and defensive stability, Lawrence.
It's a good learning, yes.
And Marouane Fellaini is the next Zidane. We'll leave it on that.
Let's definitely leave it on that. Tweet us with what you've learned from the weekend, and come Wednesday, we'll be looking through your learnings, what you're looking forward to, what you're not looking forward to. Let us know where you get your good news as well, and your bad news. It's nothing too sinister from that, please. And then obviously go find us on Wednesday when we'll be doing the Q&A podcast. Maybe the final one where Adam Boltwood is actually in within the boundaries of England before we find him somewhere else in the world. But it's been lovely to have you. Dave, in the meantime, people can head over to Dave Talks, I guess, and find you on Twitter.
Yeah, do that. Dave Talks, that'd be cool.
Yep, Dave Talks is good. Always worth a look. And obviously there'll be a lot of coverage this season. Are you doing a review of the Manchester United game this weekend, Davo?
Yeah, I've recorded it. I just obviously was busy this afternoon at a party, so I'm going to hopefully edit that at the early hours of tomorrow morning.
Wow.
And get it out, hopefully. Some interesting tactical points, I'd say.
You heard it here first. Dave gets it out on the video. And then, of course, Kristen, you're always getting it out.
Yeah, just not on video, obviously.
Mate, it pays a lot of money.
Does it?
Yeah, big money.
I think I've got a face for radio, personally. But
okay. It's very sweet you think we're talking about your face, but that's good.
That's a point as well. That's pretty weird looking too, now I come to think of it.
Wow.
I would definitely stop by Dave's channel having watched his videos, and I say that as someone who has not the greatest interest in Manchester United, but I still find it very interesting.
Or the real United, as you call them.
Yeah, that's definitely what I call them.
Yep. Chris, where can people go and find you?
I'm going to plug Facebook. If you type in my name and click the one that is not me in a Mets hat and like that one, that would be grand.
So you're telling what should people look for image-wise if they're searching you on Facebook?
It's me in a polo jumper and a pink dress shirt looking off to one side. The other account is my personal account. And while I'm very flattered that you want to know about my personal life, I do not want to share that.
And that's fair enough. Go find Chris on Facebook. Wow, Facebook. What's going on over there, eh? Is what I actually believe the Facebook manager is. So we'll see you guys on Wednesday when Adam Boltwood will be back. And we...
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Would love to hear from you guys in the meantime. We'll see you again real soon on TF3.